Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. Young people are leaving Appalachia, and they have been for years. But home sometimes looks better once you've moved away. Maybe the whole grass is greener kind of thing, you know? Today we're going to be checking in with people who miss Appalachia. How do they deal with longing for home, and why did they leave?
As a teen, I just couldn't wait to get out. I yearned for excitement, for diversity. I just felt like I didn't belong. I was bored. There was nothing to do.
I guess if you ask anybody who's left the mountains, they'll tell you that they stick with you. And no matter where I moved or how far I went from home, I always felt like a mountain boy at heart.
So all these black families that grew up in Benham, Lynch, and Cumberland come back for Memorial Day weekend. I just grew up thinking that on Memorial Day weekend, everybody went back to their ancestral home.
These stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome. Inside Appalachia, I'm Jessica Lilly. So I grew up in southern West Virginia, and maybe like you, I always planned to get out and move to the big city. Ever since I can remember, I wanted to move to live in New York City. Many of the people I went to school with have left. But as I got older, I realized that there was something here at home that I'd never get anywhere else. I'm not sure I can tell you exactly what it is, but the first time I really noticed how much I appreciate the mountains was during a trip to Michigan. I remember thinking how empty it felt just to look out and see flat land. There's something exciting and beautiful to me about seeing different shapes and landscapes made by nature. And it's nice not to have to lock your door. I know I'd miss Appalachia if I left. Just like even being an hour and a half away from my hometown of Mullins makes me a little homesick. So, how about you? Did you leave home? One of our listeners recently reached out and sent us her story about making a home for herself in the city after she left West Virginia.
Hi, my name's Ashley Biega, and I grew up in Wheeling, West Virginia. It's in the northern panhandle, and I now live in Pittsburgh. I was raised in the country on a land that housed my grandfather's farm. When I think about West Virginia, I think about agriculture and just nature and life. And we grew up, we spent our summers in the woods, we helped with our parents' garden, we stacked wood.
I once stood up on this mountain. Blue sky over me.
And as a teen, I just couldn't wait to get out. I yearned for excitement, for diversity. I just felt like I didn't belong. I was bored. There was nothing to do. And I graduated high school and moved to Pittsburgh to attend college, and I just loved it. It was exciting. It was fun. And after getting my teaching degree, I found a job in the city, and I never moved back home. And life's cyclical. Life is just cyclical. The older that I get, the more I forget all of the things that led me out of the state. And I'm filled with all the wonderful things that are instilled in me and make me so proud to be from West Virginia. My fiancé and I purchased a home in the city a few years ago, and we made sure that it had a little bit of land for a garden. I spend hours there every single day. I grow fruit, vegetables, herbs, and even mushrooms. And being in the garden is like being back home. It's humbling work that speaks to the ethics of my parents, my grandparents, and the people of West Virginia. I go home whenever I can to see my family. When I do, I hike, we cook food, and I spend times in the woods foraging for seasonal treasures like ramps and morels and pawpaws. And I may never move back, but I like to think that I took a piece of the state with me. And you can be certain that you will see me at what I would think is Wheeling's unofficial homecoming, Ogabee Fest, and it's the first weekend in October. So maybe I'll see you there. Thanks.
That was Ashley Biega, a native of Wheeling, West Virginia. Her story about moving away from the country yet trying to find a way to cultivate her West Virginia roots got us to thinking. You know, we hear lots of stories of once bustling boom towns in Appalachia. Just how many folks have moved away from Appalachia? We looked up the numbers. The mass exodus from the mountains didn't start overnight. A lot of Appalachian towns have been losing population since the 1950s. According to the Appalachian Regional Commission, during the past generation, the U.S. population has grown at a pace nearly twice that of Appalachia's. West Virginia is the only state that is completely within Appalachia, and it's losing population faster than any other in our country, with about 3,300 total residents lost from July 1, 2013 to July 1, 2014. And Appalachia's population is aging as more and more young people leave for the cities. Throughout the country, young people have flocked to major cities for access to jobs and other opportunities. Since there are few major cities in Appalachia, our region continues to witness a steady out-migration of adults between the ages of 18 and 35. The move to the city sometimes leaves people unsatisfied, and homesick Appalachians often say that the longing for the mountains puts things in a totally new perspective. Home sometimes looks better once you've moved away. Many songwriters from Appalachia have written about this special homesickness for the hills, like in this song, Big Sewell Mountain by John Wyatt, who left his home of Greenbrier County, West Virginia in the 1960s. Let's listen.
I was born on a farm on Big Sewell Mountain, and I lived with my daddy. I was 16. Then I got the urge to go mountain, see all the good life I'd never seen.
John Wyatt says he remembers that he wanted to leave Appalachia just as soon as he turned 18. He says the feeling to leave West Virginia started when he was 12, when John F. Kennedy was campaigning in West Virginia. John heard a news anchor use a word he'd never heard before. The word was poverty.
They said the poor, poverty-stricken youth of Appalachia, with no hope for the present and no hope for the future. And when I heard that, something clicked in my brain. It just floored me. I remember asking my dad. I didn't know what poverty meant. I knew what the word poor was, but I was 12 years old. I had no idea really, you know, what poverty really meant.
So John asked his father what poverty meant. But his father either didn't know himself or didn't want to explain it to John. So he told John to look in the dictionary the next day at school.
So the next day when I went to school, I got the dictionary and I read what poverty meant. And, it did something to my psyche, to me as a 12-year-old boy in Appalachia. And I realized that I was lacking in something that, you know, the rest of the young people in the rest of the country, you know, they had. So from that time, from the time I was 12 years old until I graduated from high school, that's all I wanted to do was get away from Appalachia, get away from the farm, get away from rural America and go to the city and be like all the other urban people and have opportunity and have everything that supposedly was there and wasn't here.
John grabbed an opportunity to leave West Virginia when he was still in high school.
When I was a sophomore in high school, that summer, I went to Philadelphia and worked that summer. My cousins worked building construction trade, and so I worked with them. My junior year in high school, I went to D.C. and worked in the Woodbridge area and did the same kind of work, and just in construction work, you know, and then I joined the Army and spent 3 years in the Army during Vietnam. I didn't go to Vietnam. I was in Europe most of the time. But I kept searching for whatever it was that was that we didn't have in Appalachia. I kept looking for it, and I just couldn't find whatever it was that I was looking for. When I was about 23, I was sitting in a little apartment on the west side of Cleveland, and I thought to myself, whatever it was that was supposed to be here in the city or out here somewhere in this big wide world, it can't compare to what was back there in West Virginia, in Appalachia.
Walking down a dirt road on my way back home, looking for a place I can call my own. Spent too many years trying to find my way, and I'm taking the dirt road home today.
For folks coming back or staying in Appalachia now or in West Virginia, it's tough. I mean, people are leaving in droves, leaving West Virginia.
Still, John says that even as so many people are leaving, others are returning home.
A lot of the people who are coming back, though, are the ones like myself now who retired, who went to Detroit and worked in the car, in the automobile industry, and some who went to Cleveland or D.C. or wherever. And they're moving back. They've retired and they bought the old home place and they've come back.
Down the road there's a cabin in the tall, tall pines. Dear old dad and mama that I left behind. Sweetheart, friends and loved ones that I long to see.
And many things here haven't changed very much at all since John's generation was growing up in the 1950s. And that's something that he values, that home can still feel like home to him after all these years.
Places in Appalachia, you can go and you can find people just like they were when I was growing up, and they're real and they're honest, and they have a outgoing, you know, personality, and I mean they just you know, first time you meet them, they'll come up and they'll still pinch my cheek, you know, even though I'm 67 years old. Some old granny woman will come up and pinch my cheek and say, "Oh, honey," you know, and like they used to when I was a kid. And it's a great place to live, great place to be a part of.
The special homesickness he felt for Appalachia is something he just can't explain to other people.
There was just something about Appalachia that, and it wasn't just home. It wasn't because it was my home or, you know, my school chums were there or my sweetheart was back there or anything like that. It was something about this place that we call Appalachia. There's just something, it's almost tangible. You could almost touch it. I mean, it's something that's real and honest and pure and good, and it's hard to explain, you know, unless you experience yourself. You know, I don't think I can explain it. I tell friends of mine who are from other places, I can't explain it to you. You have to find out for yourself.
You can have all your good life. You can have all your glamour. Have all the things that your money can buy. I'll live on my farm way up on the mountain. Have peace of mind till the day that I die.
After spending about a decade away, John Wyatt returned to his family farm in Greenbrier County, West Virginia during the 1970s. Those years spent far from home have inspired many of his songs. He hopes more young people will learn that they don't have to be ashamed of Appalachia and find a way to be successful here in the mountains.
But oh, how I miss life in this old house. The smell of
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. When we come back, we're going to hear from a homesick Appalachian who writes about what he calls a new revival of Appalachian culture.
Rainbows through
tin roof of the house we called home. Rain falls through the tin roof of the house we called home.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Looking for a rewind button? Don't worry. Inside Appalachia is available as a podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wvpublic.org. You can subscribe and listen on your own time. Like Justin Mullins, a podcast listener we were thrilled to hear from. He wrote, "I've been listening for a little over a month now, and I've burned through all the podcasts. I'm hooked. Good job, y'all. I'm originally from Kingsport, Tennessee, now living in Houston, but Appalachia is my heart. Thanks for representing it so well, and I look forward to more fantastic shows." Justin, thanks for the message, and thanks so much for listening. We hope this episode in particular helps pull at those Appalachian heartstrings. I guess you might agree that growing up, Appalachian cuisine was just home cooking. A bowl of brown beans and cornbread was a special occasion in my family. My cousin and I looked forward to the weekly bean dinners at one of the churches outside of town in Mullins. As a matter of fact, she had them at her wedding. We love them. But I personally never even heard of a ramp or a pawpaw until a few years ago, and I certainly didn't realize that folks in New York City would pay the kinds of prices they will to eat a meal cooked well, like my grandmother might have eaten back in the Great Depression. Appalachian culture is becoming pretty hip. It's hip to be square. It's hip to be square. And that new Appalachian hipness is something Mark Lynn Ferguson has written a lot about. He's the creator of a blog called The Revivalist, Word from the Appalachian South. In the last few years, he's noticed that more and more chefs across the country are starting to cook what they're calling Appalachian cuisine. Yes, it is a thing. Roxy Todd caught up with him to talk about the Appalachian revival that he's been noticing.
Mark Lynn Ferguson grew up in Roanoke, Virginia, where his family's roots date back for hundreds of years. Like many Appalachians, he didn't think there was anything very special about Appalachia, and he left the area when he went to college. But the more he traveled, the more he missed home. Then, 5 years ago, he had an idea.
I'm a little embarrassed to admit it, but by that point, I had been living outside of Appalachia about as long as I had been living inside of Appalachia. And I guess if you ask anybody who's left the mountains, they'll tell you that they stick with you. And no matter where I moved or how far I went from home, I always felt like a mountain boy at heart. And eventually I decided I had to get back and I wanted to be closer. So I moved from Boston, where I'd been living for about 8 years, down to D.C., and that was better. That put me about an hour and a half drive from some really good hiking in the Blue Ridge Mountains. But it still didn't make Appalachia a day-to-day part of my life. And eventually, I decided that if I started a blog, I would be able to do that. So I started The Revivalist to stay connected to my homeland.
Mark says he called it The Revivalist because he's seeing a revival of interest in Appalachian culture, and he also wants to help introduce the joys of life in Appalachia to more people.
You know, I think Roanoke and really all of Appalachia is seeing a big revival, and I should say that parts of the region are still struggling, and they're having a hard time economically, and we need to figure out how to continue helping them improve, but a lot of areas, including the panhandle of West Virginia, Shenandoah Valley, Roanoke, Asheville, Eastern Tennessee, they're doing really well. And I think our cultural influence outside the mountains has never been bigger.
Tourists from D.C. and other cities continue to visit Appalachian towns like Asheville, North Carolina, and Floyd, Virginia.
Yeah, I think this is the next big area of growth for Appalachian culture, and it's one that's just now taking off. I've seen several Appalachian cookbooks hit the shelves in recent years, but I think that's exactly what's happening. Chefs, whether they're in Charleston or in Chicago, are starting to discover our food traditions.
What does Appalachian cuisine mean exactly? Mark says it varies. Everything from wild mushrooms and ramps to southern recipes like shrimp and grits.
You know, it's really interesting. You go to a lot of restaurants and you'll see one or two dishes that are clearly drawn from Appalachia. And now I actually know of four of them that call themselves out-and-out Appalachian restaurants. And that's kind of exciting. One is in Brooklyn. It's called Montana's Trail House. Now, the owner's name is Montana. It has nothing to do with the state. He has themed the restaurant, though, like the kind of place that you would find along the Appalachian Trail. And he serves a lot of foods that you would find along the Appalachian Trail, like fried chicken biscuits and fried potatoes, this dish they called barnyard trout, which is roasted with ham, which sounds utterly delicious to me. Another restaurant is called Hillbilly Tea. It was actually started in Louisville, Kentucky, but it now has a second location, and you'll never guess where it is. Shanghai. The guy who started it is an Appalachian native and has just such wonderful memories of growing up in the mountains that he drew from his grandparents' recipes and built a restaurant around it.
One of the things that defines what Mark sees as a growing popularity in Appalachian food is that most of these chefs cook with ingredients that are sourced from the wild.
One example that jumps out for me immediately is ramps. It may be the best example. It used to be that, you know, only mountain folks would go stomping around in the woods and dig up these leeks and take them to their kitchens and stink up the whole house with them. But now they're at every farmer's market. They're huge in the cities. You can't go to New York in the springtime and not see it on restaurant menus there.
Still, Mark admits that this growing popularity for wild foods like ramps does have its drawbacks. All this big city love for wild ramps could actually be depleting the wild population of ramps from the forest here in Appalachia. In the Great Smoky Mountain National Park in North Carolina and Tennessee, concerns for wild ramps led to a ban of harvesting there in 2004. Mark doesn't think folks in the big cities are aware of the impact their fancy dinners may be having on the wild ramp populations.
I would love to say they're being that thoughtful, but I don't know that that's the case. And I have heard similar concerns about, you know, really destroying ramp populations in forests and over-cultivating them.
And as with ramps, Mark recognizes that the entire revival of Appalachian culture poses another really complicated issue. What's the ultimate price and payoff of Appalachian culture suddenly becoming popular and enticing to big city yuppies?
You know, I think it's a double-edged sword. There's always the risk of misappropriation, but after, I can't even say decades, more than a century of bad press about Appalachia and us being stereotyped as ignorant and backwoods and poverty-stricken and hillbillies, a little bit of appropriation might actually help us out. I think it's probably valuable that people outside the region start to recognize the wealth of culture that we have here and start to value that, because you're going to see greater appreciation for Appalachia and greater investment in Appalachia. And I can see where a lot of locals would be suspicious. There've certainly been outside interests that have come in the past and taken advantage of the region in some pretty despicable ways. But it can also do a lot of good.
So like in some Appalachian cities like Asheville, Roanoke, and Lewisburg, the growing popularity for heritage and cultural tourism do bring more wealth to our region. Mark believes that all this interest in Appalachian culture makes the region more attractive to investors. And that's good for local economies. But are diners in Appalachian restaurants in New York City seeing the real Appalachia?
Yeah, well, you know, the food piece in particular totally enthralls me. I think we're in a really interesting time with Appalachian food. You've got the culinary elite starting to really draw inspiration from it and replicate it in their restaurants. Yet back home, I think a lot of regular folks are less connected to our food traditions than their parents and their grandparents were. And I include myself in that category. I was raised in the Blue Ridge Mountains, and growing up, nobody was handing me a pawpaw or feeding me apple stack cake or giving me Kushaw pie.
Kushaw pie, by the way, is kind of like Appalachian pumpkin pie made with squash. Pawpaws are a fruit that grow wild in Appalachia, And as for the apple stack cake, just imagine dried apples, molasses, and buttermilk all baked in an iron skillet.
I did, however, eat a whole lot of Little Debbie Swiss cake rolls, and I ate a lot of McRibs, and I love Krispy Kreme donuts. And I think there are probably a lot of people who are like me.
Mark says, maybe. It's all Appalachian cuisine, the junk food and the traditional dishes.
So this weird place that we're in, where you have fancy restaurants serving Appalachian food, but us eating less of it back home, really has got me to thinking lately and asking, what does Appalachian food mean anymore?
So all this has led Mark to celebrate the Revivalist blog's 5-year anniversary with a special photo contest called Appalachian Appetite. And dozens of people have submitted their photos of their favorite Appalachian food.
It's been an amazing variety. Everything from kale chips to hot dogs over a campfire to canned blackberries to pork tacos to beer bread. There have been lots and lots and lots of pie photos. I think it's just this really revealing look at what food means in Appalachia and what Appalachia is inspiring people to eat in other places.
The grand prize winner of the Revivalist Photo Contest is going to be rewarded with a 2-night getaway at the historic Mass Farm Inn in Valley Crucis, North Carolina. Just near the Pisgah National Forest, the inn's restaurant serves North Carolina rainbow trout and grits from cornmeal that's ground at a mill in South Carolina. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston, West Virginia.
And on our website, we've posted some of the photos from the Revivalist's photo contest, which is called Appalachian Appetite. Kind of like the name of our regular food segments here on Inside Appalachia that we call Appetite Appalachia, only in the other order. Come check it out and see if you're not starving after you see some of these. That's at wvpublic.org. Today we've been talking to some people who left Appalachia, either for work, school, or just to get out and explore a less rural, remote part of the world. But for so many Appalachians, the memories of the mountains, of something almost indescribable, makes folks long for home. And visiting home again can sometimes feel like stepping back in time for many of them. After all, compared with the rest of the country, so much of Appalachia has been overlooked by developers who want to put up strip malls and fast food places that the towns here have scarcely changed. Only the people, in some cases, have left. Still, some say that returning back home, even if only for a short time, can be restorative, too. Next, we're going to hear two West Virginians who have moved away talk about what it means to come home. Anna Sell is the host and managing editor of Death, Sex, and Money at WNYC in New York City. Her podcast was named Best of 2014 by iTunes in the new podcast category. Plus, it hit the top of BuzzFeed's list for the best 12 new podcasts that will make you a better human. Earlier this summer, Anna traveled back to her home of Charleston, West Virginia for a special taping of Death, Sex, and Money during the city's yearly festival celebration. She was joined on stage by New York Times literary critic Dwight Garner, who's a native of Marion County, West Virginia.
When I really noticed Dwight Garner's writing, the piece that I was like, who is this guy? He was writing a travel piece about driving to West Virginia. And in it, he had a few sentences that I think you'll like. He called Charleston lovelier than a small city surrounded by heavy industry should be able to be, with a warm southern vibe. And then he described Interstate 79 as cutting ambitiously against the grain of the Appalachian Mountains in the no-nonsense manner of all West Virginians and leading to home. Isn't that beautiful? Can you talk about how you think of West Virginia as far as home? Because I think it's interesting that you didn't live here for that many years.
Well, I moved away in second or third grade. I moved to Naples, Florida. And, you know, I can't say that my childhood was not terrific there. I enjoyed it. But it's sort of a nowhere place in some way. It's sort of a place that doesn't have, there's no there there. I mean, there's a great beach and there's some culture to Naples, but it's a lot of people from Ohio who moved down to get away, as my family did. You know, we moved, people who moved to get away from the north. And I started coming back, or I always came back, but started coming back more often to visit my grandparents. My grandfather was a coal miner, lived in Mannington, and my other grandfather worked for the Coca-Cola bottling plant in Fairmont. And coming back here, you felt like, well, this is a place, you know? I mean, this is really, there's something real here. And the writers that come here, I began to really admire, particularly Brees, DJ Pancake, and Gina Ann Phillips, among many others. You know, it's funny, so much of culture in terms of writers and any kind of artist is, it's sort of like, you know, rowing, you know, skull, boat racing. You're sort of pulling in one direction away while looking back exactly where you came from. And that's how so many people who leave places get, they're just fixated on where they came from. And increasingly, I sort of feel that way. I feel like my family heritage is here. And I keep telling friends that this should become the new place. I mean, it should be the next Wyoming where all the writers move, because you can buy a great house here for, you know, what you get, you know, a shed in everywhere else in West Virginia. So,
what would you do when you'd come and visit your family in West Virginia?
What would I do?
Yeah, as a kid.
Oh, God, just run around, you know? I went to basketball camp. I keep saying that the basketball camp was run by Mary Lou Retton's father, but people seem to disabuse me of that notion. They must be misremembering, but I'm sure it was.
That's cool.
Yeah, in the 70s. And, you know, just ran around Mannington, West Virginia. You know, the old soda shop was still there, and you could still get a soda for 10 cents and, you know, pulling it out of that machine. It just, Naples, Florida at the time was the fastest growing city in America, I think. And just, you know, the malls had come through, and just it just felt empty to me. And it was a great joy to come back here.
I'm going to out Dwight as not an outdoor person.
I was once offered a job at Outside Magazine, and I said, well, if you call it Inside Magazine, I might think about it, which is a bit of a joke. But
And that's the way you started your meditation on driving home to West Virginia, with that very story.
Oh, I did.
Yeah, and you said, but it was interesting because you said, the way I reflect is not by going out into nature, it's not by climbing mountains, it's by getting in my car with a stack of CDs and rolling down the windows, mostly at night. And then you said this paragraph. This was the paragraph where I was like, oh, he's from West Virginia. And this was when I was like, I need to be friends with him. Because he wrote, I need these trips to see myself plain. I take out my failings as a husband, as a father, and as a man, and put them on the dashboard where I can study them, like the imagery of a moral GPS unit, one that allows you to scan for alternate routes and toll-free bridges.
Aww. Where, thank you.
Isn't that beautiful?
Yes, it is. That was Anna Sale talking with New York Times literary critic Dwight Garner. Both Dwight and Anna are native Appalachians who have gone on to work in New York City. You can listen to the rest of this conversation on Monday, August 31st at 6:30 p.m. on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Lots of people who leave Appalachia refer to home as the place in the mountains where they spent their childhood, or sometimes even where their parents grew up. They return to visit, even bringing their children there, teaching them that Appalachia is and always will be their home. That's what Carita Brown remembers as a child. She grew up outside of Appalachia, but her parents moved away from Lynch, Kentucky before she was even born. Carita got to know her Appalachian family roots when her parents would bring her back for, yep, you guessed it, festivals or community celebrations. Recently, she traveled back to Lynch after missing 10 years of these celebrations.
And I went home, and I sat on my grandmother's porch, and I looked around, and, you know, all the my childhood memories of this small community that meant so much to me as a child just started flooding back. And I realized that the town was a third the size that I remember it being when I was a child.
Now, Carita Brown is a PhD student at the University of North Carolina. That trip back to Lynch inspired her to start an oral history project called the Eastern Kentucky African American Migration Project. For WUNC's The State of Things, Frank Statio recently sat down with Carita Brown and her father, Richard Brown, about her work collecting oral histories from Eastern Kentucky.
Carita Brown grew up in New York, but her parents are from Lynch, Kentucky. It's one of the many formerly thriving towns that once sat at the heart of Kentucky's coal country. Her new project examines the history and culture of the area and captures the stories of more than 200 people who still call that place home. An exhibit of her work is currently on view at UNC Chapel Hill's Wilson Library. It's called Gone Home, Race and Roots Through Appalachia. And Carita Brown joins me in the studio now for a preview. Carita, welcome to State of Things. Good to have you here.
Oh, good to be here.
So talk about these visits back to this place where you grew up.
So during my parents' generation, it was customary for children to graduate high school and the next day to migrate to another city across the United States. And this happened concomitantly with what's known as the African-American Great Migration, right? So my parents moved to New York and raised my brother and I there. But every Memorial Day weekend since I was in my mother's womb, my parents made sure to take us back to Lynch, Kentucky, where they grew up. And it wasn't just my family. This was a tradition in the community. So all these Black families that grew up in Benham, Lynch, and Cumberland come back for Memorial Day weekend. And for that weekend, if you and I were neighbors growing up, we'd be neighbors again in our family homes, because it's important to remember that the company left a lot of those homes to those families when they deserted the area. So a lot of families still own their home houses. And during Memorial Day weekend, there would be tons of festivities in the ballparks and barbecuing, and all the families would be reconnecting. And I just grew up thinking that on Memorial Day weekend, everybody went back to their ancestral home and resurrected communities that had gone away.
Well, Richard Brown is your father. He is with you today. He's also was born and raised in Lynch and also served as Carita's assistant throughout this process, and he is here today. Richard, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's glad to be here.
Well, tell us about growing up in Lynch.
Well, it was a very close-knit family. That's the easiest way to put it, the most way you can understand it. It was a small town, and we lived down in the valley, surrounded by the mountains. And everybody knew everybody, and if you did something wrong, they will give you a beating. meaning your neighbor, not your mom. And then after that, they will get in touch with your parents and say, I just whooped Richard for XYZ. And on your way home, you're crying because you know you're going to get it another one when you get home. And today, parents believe everything the kids tell them.
Yeah.
And my mom, my dad, if a grown-up beat you, you couldn't go there. I couldn't go there and say, they did this and they didn't. They don't hear that. Yeah. You get extra licks
for
that.
That would just be worse, right?
Yeah. and you just couldn't get away with anything. It was a good part of it and it's a bad part. Yeah. The good part of it was just keep you in line and kept your morals and kept you on the straight and kept you out of trouble. The bad part about it, you couldn't get in no trouble, and that ain't no fun.
Well, there's a lot of people who seem to agree with you, and I know that you found a lot of this. Carita found a lot of this when she did her interviews. We could confirm this with Brenda Combs, who's one of the people you talked with.
Everybody was your parent. I mean, everybody could tell you what to do, when to do it, when not to do it, you know, and if you did something wrong, they could actually spank you. And you, oh gosh, you were really in trouble when you got back home. If you walked around the street 100 times, you had to say hello to everybody sitting on their porch in their yard 100 times. Even till this day, you still have to do that. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody watched out for everybody. You didn't have to lock your doors. You know, you can leave your doors open.
As you say, that's the good part of it. But there was this mandate. There was this maybe it was an overt understanding that everybody who would the kids they'd graduate from high school, and they'd be gone by the following weekend, right?
Yes. Well, that started with the father, because working in the coal mine, if he was to see what they had to endure, my father said to all the boys, my brothers, that I don't want you to work in this coal mine. It's too dangerous. It's just depleting. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want it better for you. Get your education and get out. So it was just known because I graduated on a Friday. On a Saturday, I was on the bus to New York.
And you weren't alone.
No, I was not alone. The bus was for some people that I knew that graduated with me was on that bus, too. And then we went to different places. We went to New York. We went to Cleveland. It was just you getting out of there. And so you wouldn't be tempted to work in the mines. So that was automatic. And not just my family. That was a tradition, it seemed like to me. That was just automatic. You got to go.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You can imagine trying to make a living for your family, but hoping they don't have to endure the same hardship. So off they go. So, Carita, why come back? Tell us what you learned as a researcher about these reunions.
Oh, man. So my research really is centered around the concept of home. And what I learned is whatever it is that they got from that close-knit community and that upbringing in Kentucky stayed with them and really defines some part of their being. And many participants will describe it that way, that a piece of my soul rests in those mountains. So there's something about the landscape and the experiences and the shared history, joy and pain, that draws these people back. It's common to say, you know, when I, at the end of each interview, I touch my heart and I ask my participants, where's home for you? And a common response is, well, I live in XYZ city, but Lynch will always be my home.
I think that's something that Cynthia Brown Harrington probably confirms in your interview with her.
I looked forward to going home. I used to put my vacation in. I think I went home at least 25 years in a row straight. Yes, that and the reunions. That just that camaraderie to see each other. And there's not many people in the world that do that. And when I tell people about it, it's unreal to them. They was like, y'all actually go back like that? Sure we do. It's good to see kids that you went to school with. It was great to see your old teachers. Your friends, to go to church and remember singing the songs, being baptized. It was good. It was just a connection to the whole community. And Kentucky at that time of the year is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's really picturesque. And, you know, when you're young and you're growing up there, you didn't really see all that. But once you left and came back, you saw the beauty of it.
That was Cynthia Brown Harrington, who was born and raised in Lynch, Kentucky, and now lives in Greensboro, North Carolina. We also heard from Brenda Combs, another former resident of Eastern Kentucky. Their interviews are two of more than 200 recorded for the Eastern Kentucky African American Migration Project. Carita Brown is a PhD student at the University of North Carolina who collected the project. She and her father were talking with Frank Statio, host of The State of Things from WUNC. Carita's oral history project is on exhibit through August 26th at the Wilson Library at UNC Chapel Hill. And if you happen to be near Indianapolis over Labor Day, get this, the East Kentucky Social Club, which was founded in Lynch, Kentucky, holds a yearly Labor Day celebration for people who have migrated to Indiana. Over the decades, thousands of African Americans with ties to Lynch have been involved with the East Kentucky Social Club. Carita Brown will be displaying her exhibit at the Indianapolis chapter of the organization on Labor Day weekend for the 46th annual reunion. On today's show, we're talking about Appalachians who have moved away but miss these mountains. We've heard from folks who come back to visit often during festivals to help satisfy their desire to connect to their home place. These events also draw in visitors to Appalachia. And we also talked earlier in our show about how Appalachia is drawing in tourists who want to experience our cultural heritage. Recently, West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle held a celebration of its African American history, the 23rd annual African American Heritage and Culture Festival in Jefferson County. From a parade to live music and a memorial walk to the original site of John Brown's fort, the festival offered a variety of events for visitors. It was organized by the NAACP of Jefferson County, and they say the weekend is meant to bring people together and remind the history that helped shape the country into what it is today. Liz McCormick of West Virginia Public Broadcasting visited the festival and brings us these sounds from the event.
Stacy Grant, and my husband and I over here with a couple other friends. We live in Boise. We come every year. You are here to support one another. You're here to support the vendors that are here. Brings people into Charlestown to know the history of Charlestown, whether it's African-American or any history. It just brings you all together so that you can come together as one and celebrate.
The next participate approaching will be the Down and Dirty Motorcycle Clinic.
Come to this festival every year because it's really, really good, you know, for all the cultures to get together, because you need to know your history, regardless of what color you are, because now everything is more diversified because you have more biracial, and everybody needs to know what set of where they all come from.
Watching the parade, just watching the vendors, being able to talk to everybody who's been involved with the festival. I have had the food. I've enjoyed the fish, the southern fried fish. That's always a popular a dish when they come to the festival.
Hi, I'm Keith Carter. I'm here every year. You know, this is something that people need to know about because it's an African heritage, you know, and to know about your heritage is very important, you know, and it's sharpened the kids up in, you know, in today's age, you know, what the difference is from then it is now, you know, and with everything that's going on in the world, you know, it's tough, you know, so hopefully they get something out of it.
My name is Alea Carter, and we come here mostly every time, but it's just pretty cool. I just like coming to see everything.
Well, let's see, it's important to see all the different cultures, so I like seeing all that.
James Talbert. I've been president of the West Virginia NAACP, I've been with the festival ever since it started. My mother thought about it after seeing other cities, other groups doing the same thing across the country. So felt it was needed here, especially the fact that you have so much history here, and that history ought to be exchanged. At that time, there was only one black festival going on in West Virginia. But then she thought it necessary to bring to Eastern Panhandle, and it happened.
I can read his righteous sanctness by the dimmest glaring lamp. His day is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah.
Pastor Paul Brown, we never forget the struggles of the past and the events that happened to help us get to where we are now. And we want to come back and commemorate this each year. We hope the group becomes larger and larger and larger as people remember. But history is important because you don't want to relive the mistakes of the past, but you want to celebrate the victories.
Thank you.
That was an audio postcard from Liz McCormick at the 23rd Annual African American Heritage and Culture Festival in Jefferson County. Last week, we heard about some favorite signature foods that Appalachians love, including West Virginia's unofficial state food, the pepperoni roll. We heard about store-bought and even talked a little about school lunch pepperoni rolls. But what about homemade pepperoni rolls? One of our colleagues at West Virginia Public Broadcasting remembers eating his mother's homemade pepperoni rolls growing up. Our friend Adam Harris still lives in West Virginia, a few hours away from his parents in Greenbrier County. So he doesn't get to enjoy his mom's pepperoni rolls as much as when he was a kid. Adam called up his mother to talk to her about how she makes her own homemade variety of pepperoni rolls, and here's a bit of their conversation.
Somebody asked me today when I first had a pepperoni roll. And I know it would have been one of yours, and so I wanted to ask you where you would have heard or had your first pepperoni roll, and then why did you decide to make them at home?
It was just the idea I came up with. I thought, well, if you can buy them, you can make them.
Well, you were famous for your roll recipe.
Yeah.
You were making those before you were making pepperoni rolls, right?
Right. And, of course, I use my own roll dough. Everybody's roll dough is different. And I don't have a recipe for it. I just throw it all together.
So what would you put in them?
Three pieces of pepperoni, and I put one. Well, I take one piece of pepperoni and put a hunk of cheddar cheese, and then two pieces of pepperoni on top of that, and wrap them in my roll dough.
And bake them for how long?
Oh dear, I think it's 12 minutes.
Okay. So do you think the first pepperoni roll you would have eaten would have been one that you made?
Yeah, probably so. And I can't even remember when I started making them. Yeah. And we used to dip them in spaghetti sauce. Do you remember that?
Well, that's what I've
just eating them plain while they're hot.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they're better hot.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't. That's one of the debates, is if you serve them with marinara or whatever or not, you know, and does it have cheese or not? Or, you know, some people put hot cheese, some people, you know.
Right, and some people don't put any cheese at all.
Right. What do you think about stick pepperoni?
I've never made them with the stick pepperoni.
That's what I thought.
You're about the first survey person this evening on this phone. For old surveys and for presidents and this, that, and the other, you know.
So, am I the first survey you decided to do?
Yeah. The rest of them I hung up on.
Well, good. Well, at least we got to talk about a matter that's important.
Exactly.
Do you want to say anything else about pepperoni rolls?
No, nothing other than I know all my family likes them, right?
That's right. We all do.
And I like them best when they're hot.
Are you craving pepperoni rolls now?
Yes.
All right, well, I'll let you go.
Okay,
all
love
right.
You.
I love you too, Mom.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was our colleague and executive producer of Mountain Stage, Adam Harris, speaking with his mom, Catherine Harris, about pepperoni rolls. Speaking of pepperoni rolls, we have a quick update for you. Remember last week we talked about the controversy that erupted when Sheetz convenience stores decided they'd stop stocking pepperoni rolls made in West Virginia? West Virginians wrote angry notes on social media and called for a boycott. So Sheetz reversed that decision and said they would select a West Virginia bakery to make the pepperoni rolls it sells in West Virginia. We've been waiting to hear which bakery it would be, and now we know. The bakery they chose is Home Industry Bakery in Clarksburg. And our producer, Roxy Todd, confirmed its pepperoni rolls have pepperoni sticks as well as slices. Thanks for listening to our show about folks who miss this place after they move away. And who could blame them? There's nothing like a West Virginia pepperoni roll. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WUNC's The State of Things and WNYC. Music in today's show was provided by Andy Agnew Jr., John Wyatt, the Glenville State Bluegrass Band, and Tom Breeding. We also heard a little Huey Lewis in the News with It's Hip to Be Square. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Our producer is Roxy Todd. Our editor is Catherine Winter. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.